Edwin Diaz is back. He looked great. We got to talk about that. We've got some rumors. Yeah, late in the spring, JD Martinez and JD Davis talk about that. The batting order conversation and the spring breakout are all coming up on this episode of the Messed Up Podcast. What is up, Mets fans? Welcome back to another episode of the Messed Up Podcast. I am super excited to be back in New York City, even though the weather was beautiful in Florida. It's been great here in New York in the 20 minutes I've been home since I've gotten off the plane. But we've got a lot of things to talk about. Like we said in the intro, Edwin Diaz, spring breakout, the JD rumors for both of them. What's the batting order going to look like? Everything is starting to get a little bit closer to the season, a little bit more exciting, a little more pressure here. So excited to talk about it with you guys. As always, make sure you're following us on our social media at Mets Up on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Subscribe to the Mets Up Podcast YouTube channel if you have not yet already. We're approaching 4,100 subscribers. Appreciate you all out there. And if you're listening to us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever it is, download the podcast, subscribe, drop us a rating, drop us a review. Really does help us as we get going into the season. James, how you holding it down in New York these last few days?
It's been great. I mean, daylight savings, got rid of the seasonal depression. How was Florida, dude?
I had a great time. It was great to be out in the sun, played a nice round of golf, obviously, as we can see now with a little bit better of a camera. Got some color on my face, but it's looking great. This is some of the best color I've gotten in a while in terms of the suntan, so I'm feeling good there. And also got to watch a little bit of Mets baseball. Got to watch Edwin Diaz make his spring training debut. I might be one of the few people on the planet that saw the last pitch and the first pitch he's thrown since what's been going on. It's like me and Francisco Lindor, I think, in terms of guys who've seen it, which is a weird feeling.
And the bullpen coach, what's his name, Rosado?
Oh, yes, and Rosado, yes. He's seen the last Ed first pitch. Yeah, so I'm in elite company, there we go. Elite company here, I'm still on Florida brain. But yeah, let's talk about Diaz first, because I think in terms of actual baseball and players that are on this team that matters right now, we obviously know how super important he was. And at the stadium, I'll tell you the vibes, which is crazy, at Clover Park, electric. They did the trumpets, and obviously it's not the same at Citi Field. They're gonna have those crazy lights this year going, but like everybody got on their feet. There was a noticeable buzz that he was coming out and throwing those pitches, and then to strike out the side, people were going nuts. Like, you would think that this was a game that actually mattered.
I could definitely understand why it would seem crazy from the outside, the fact that there's this much hoopla and fanfare around a spring training game, but I just think that's how much Edwin Diaz means to this team and how strangely and bizarrely he was taken away from the Mets and Mets fans last year, basically a year to the date of his return on almost the eve of the season, the World Baseball Classic. And just he talked about how amazing the fans were, like how he was kind of overcome by emotion because of how excited everybody seemed. Just, it was nice to see. And just the fact that he did come back and he was fully electric was, I think, the biggest thing for us Mets fans, the roster, everything. Because he's kind of like a heartbeat for this team. Like him, and also the song. I feel like a lot of people on Twitter, not the Mets fans, because every Mets fan on Twitter used this song, played this clip, got impressions out the ass. But I think outside people are like, oh my God, you're like doing a walk-up song. Like, you guys can still use this song. It's like cringe, it's corny. But I don't think a lot of people realize that this song kind of saved Edwin Diaz's career. Like, this song has more meaning than like the intro it became in 2022, where when he was down on his luck, when he was out on it, was it Nido? Was his brother? Who recommended it? I remember someone recommended it. It happened towards the end of the 21 season. And the song then just kind of molded and became this kind of larger than life thing that the Mets have now. But it's like, it's something that the whole roster can lean back on. Like, let's just win for eighth innings. Then we have the best guy in the world for the ninth. It's such a warm blanket for a baseball team.
Yeah, he looked great too. Like, I think he was sitting like 97, 98 in terms of miles per hour on the fastball. Mm-hmm. That slider was disgusting. The slider looked absolutely incredible. And I was talking to our friend of the podcast, Wardy, big Met fan, if you guys know him over on YouTube. And he was like doing some video content out there. And he goes, what do you want to see from Edwin Diaz? I'm like, throw one pitch. Like, just the mental side of things, of being able to get out there, throw that pitch after that knee injury, just get back on the mound, I think is something that is, like you said, almost going to like lift him up and lift the team up as well. It's like, okay, we got our guy back. Like, now we're ready to roll.
Also, cute moment of the week, especially surrounding what happened here. SNY put it out. The Mets put it out. Edwin Diaz's kids were watching him pitch,
awesome.
And they were going crazy, videotaping him on TV, like running around the house screaming. It was an amazing moment, really, really cute to see. But then also on the mound, like you said, he struck out the side on 15 pitches despite being down a couple ticks. And the craziest thing about this outing, he struck out the side in 15 pitches. Only two of those pitches were in the strike zone.
Nice.
So he wasn't even sharp. The stuff wasn't even there. And he still just purely dominated mostly a group of Marlins starting baseball players.
Yeah, and of course, we're going to keep tabs on him as we go throughout spring training. There's not too much else to talk about here because, I mean, he was great. The other thing, I guess, in terms of just like Mets baseball on the field was today, Carlos Mendoza also announced that Jose Quintana would be the opening day starter. I know some people felt like that was a question mark. Felt incredibly obvious to me. How about you?
No, me too. I almost wish they would have just like leaned into the craziness and just like made said Severino be the opening day starter. Just try the own one. Be like, you're good. We want you to be our guy this year. Be our guy. You're pitching really well in the spring. Also, a little bit of news. Andy Martino said the Kodai Senga rehabilitation is going very well. Mets are positive about his progress.
Nice. I like to hear positive things about a New York pitcher coming back from an injury. I like to hear that.
I'll even say this. Like, I'll give like 30 seconds Yankee stuff just because I think it's funny. If he doesn't get Tommy John, I don't think it's really that bad. If he gets Tommy John, the whole thing's over. The whole Yankee season's for naught. And it's also weird.
They should trade Juan Soto instantly.
Yeah, he has the opt-out at the end of the year, which is so funny if he gets Tommy John. Because if he opts out, the Yankees have the option to just bring him back, and they have to do it. But no one's even mentioned that. I think that's a crazy wrinkle to this.
And that's the opt-out, too, where I think he gets like even more money.
Significantly more. I think it's like more years tacked on the back. I think it's like a 3 year plus 3 years in the end of his deal, or 2 years or something like that. No one's mentioned that because it's also they don't know. He's getting more opinions. They think the best case scenario is like 2 months, which I mean we've heard this one before, Mets fans. You know what happens when you get four opinions in March.
Who's that?
But yeah, no, it's like if he actually does pitch in June and like Rodon's okay and they've Stroman and Cortez, Will Warren, they're totally fine. Like they could still win the division, they can still win the World Series. Don't tell your Yankee fans friends this that they're totally fine. Let them freak out, let them be upset. Let them get all nervous and everything because that was us for a very long time. But I think Yanks are okay. And also, I think the Mets, like, Quintana opening day, it's just good feathering. I guess he's earned it, you know?
I honestly, like, I understand why it's not Tyler McGill, but I thought it would have been funny just to, like, have the guy who's like, just meme it, like, fuck it, Tyler McGill starting again. Like, chaos opening day, we don't have our actual guy that we want. Go to Tyler McGill again. Let him run it out there.
It would be 3 years in a row for Tyler McGill, which is shocking to think about.
That's going to be like a trivia question in like 10 years on like Jeopardy. Like, this Mets back end starter made three opening day starts despite not throwing the most innings ever for this team. Who is it? Tyler McGill.
Also, just moving on now, pitching. We got some rumors happening for the first time in a little while, and they feel to me like pure bullshit. We're going to talk about them because a lot of people are talking about them, and it's J.D. Martinez and J.D. Davis, who was actually cut by the Giants to make room on their roster for newly signed Matt Chapman. But you gave me a look. You not think this is bullshit?
Do you think they're both bullshit, or do you think it's just the J.D. Martinez one? Because I think the J.D. Davis one, I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I think the J.D. Martinez one is bullshit. I think that's, like, did you see who's tweeting it out? It's the sauce boss himself, John Heyman, who is literally Scott Boras's puppet. Like, talk about someone whose strings are attached to a guy's hand. John Heyman will tweet anything that Scott Boras says. So I don't necessarily know how true the J.D. Martinez one is. The J.D. Davis one, I think, is more realistic and I think could actually happen. I don't know. Where do you stand on it?
The only thing for me that makes it feel not real is that the Mets went through this whole offseason and they were like, it's going to be a mix of Bailey, Vientos, DJ Stewart. It's going to be DH third base. Like, they've been saying that. Now 2 weeks of poor results from, albeit all three of those guys in spring training, would make them nervous. But do you think 2 weeks spring training results would make them nervous? Because the same thing is true now that was true then, which is we're still over the third tax threshold. So every single dollar that the Mets spend from here on out is being taxed 110%. So a one-year $10 million deal for J.D. Martinez or one for 12 would become one for 25 or one for 21. J.D. Davis, I believe, is still owed whoever picks him up $7 million for the season. So it's not really that much of a cost difference. J.D. Davis gives you a little more, what?
I think the Giants will still pay that because he was not claimed. I think because he wasn't claimed through waivers, the team would only have to pay the minimum because of that money being owned. So I think the Giants are on the hook for that, which is why you put a guy through waivers, because you're hoping someone will take that. They then take the contract. So I don't know if that would be the case. Because if it is, if you have to pay J.D. Davis $7 million, he's not coming. There's no way. But if you pay him the league minimum, I think that's super possible.
I thought you actually did have to, because I know there were issues with the Giants, and apparently they're already talking about a grievance being filed because J.D. Davis won his arbitration case against the Giants, and then he was immediately released, which I think is a kind of first time this has ever happened.
Oh.
It's a weird
Giants
case.
Giants used a loophole to screw over J.D. Davis. I'm reading an article about this now. Yeah. Yes. Wow, interesting.
Yeah. So it's a very weird case for J.D. right now, but also apart from the money, because right now the Mets tax bill is already expected to be between $77 and $80 million for 2024 for a team that is about the 500 ball club. And I don't think adding J.D. Davis or J.D. Martinez really puts them over the hump. I think it's a better chance J.D. Martinez does. And J.D. Davis is also interesting because forever. He was a bad third baseman, but last year the Giants actually coaxed some pretty solid defensive value out of him. But the bat is what fell off a cliff for the first time in his career. And I think that might have been just because he's never played the full season, or I don't know, maybe just the bat at the ballpark, which is not really that bad for right-handed hitters either. But I just think that if you put one of these guys on the roster, that means that Mark Vientos basically has no more spot in the 24 six-man roster. And you've talked for months about how you want to give him a look this year. You want to give the young guys a chance. And now suddenly for a DH who you don't think is really that good either, you're going to just take this guy off your roster. I don't think J.D. Davis or J.D. Martinez and Mark Vientos can be on a roster together. Because how many right-handed bats with no defensive value do you have?
No, of course not. The thing that makes me lean, I mean, like, obviously J.D. Martinez is the better hitter. I think we all know this. Yeah. If the money didn't matter, which it doesn't theoretically for us as fans, but we know it does for the team, J.D. Martinez is the pick 100 times out of 100. Like, you can't compare the two. But for me, I go like one, I look at J.D. Davis, and this is going to be a crazy, maybe this is a hot take. He's the best third baseman on the New York Mets right now. I think there's no doubt about that. And the other thing is, for those Mets fans who were so in on getting Justin Turner, you have to be in on J.D. Davis then. He's going to cost less, and he's going to probably be a similar-ish type player in terms of value, because you got to assume that Justin Turner is not going to continue to hit 800 because he's not going to be in Fenway. He also can't play third base. Like, there's just, to me, it feels like Mets fans are like in such a fucking tornado, such a twister right now, where they're like, they see redemption for Justin Turner, like when he was coming back, like, this will be our chance, we can finally get the good Justin Turner. We're on the other side with J.D. Davis, and we know, like, he swings through the fastballs down the middle, can't hit a high pitch, like, we know the holes in his game. And last year was a down year, especially like even on the Statcast side of things. But he still was rocking a barrel rate close to 10%. Even the year before, his barrel rate was 16%. He hits the ball so fucking hard. Like, there are holes in his game, but he also does those fun things that, like, I think if his name was like Jim Smith, people would be a lot more interested rather than J.D. Davis, because we know what we saw before.
It's also, we've talked a lot about Mets third base positioning for the last couple of months. And last year, the Giants did a lot with J.D. Davis, where they pushed him back and put him right on the line because he has that cannon of an arm. It really helps his defensive metrics. He was actually one of the top third basemen in baseball in terms of OAA on Baseball Savant. And 1 year, OAA isn't the most reliable thing in the world, but it did happen. Like, he was defensively, technically, statistically, in 2023, a standout defensive third baseman, which is more than you could probably say for the guys in the Mets roster. And I am worried about J.D. Martinez because he's like, what, 36 now? 37?
I think he might even be even older. I think he might be 38. No, you're right. I think you're 36 is right. I think you're right. Yeah, 36 years old.
Yeah, and every single year for him, because he was never a big play discipline guy. He was always a hacker, but he just did so much damage in the zone that it worked. But every year you get older, you get a little bit worse, I think, at making solid contact in those pitches outside the strike zone. I'm always just worried about the musical chairs game with a guy like J.D. Martinez, who's like, there's no defensive value either. Like, you sign him to be a DH, and on June 7th, he's hitting .215 with three homers, and he's not playing defense, and he's striking out 30% of the time. You're like, why is this guy on the team? Why the pay for this guy on the team? So it's just like, if you're not fully ready for the downside of this, I don't know if you could really take on the upside, which I still think for J.D. Martinez is pretty good. It's probably a guy's 20-30% better than league average, but does that kind of a player give the Mets enough of wins right now to make ownership be like, I'm willing to double spend money if this is a playoff piece for us?
Yeah, that's the thing, because like, how much of a difference does this make? We even heard Steve Cohen talk about this last year, about like the playoff percentages and why they ended up moving Scherzer and Verlander. And it was like, yes, we still could have made the playoffs. There was a chance. But like, from a analytical financial standpoint, like everything considered, it was a smarter decision and a better decision for our future chances at making the playoffs to get rid of these guys, where like J.D. Martinez is going to help this team be a playoff contender. There's no doubt about it, I think. But how much does that cost? And the thing that also is super turning me off to J.D. Martinez right now, too, is it is March 13th. There are teams that need power bats. The Dodgers didn't want him after he had an incredible year. Like, there's something to say about a guy who had a really good season and nobody wants him. And I don't know how I put my finger on it, but everyone can't be missing on this guy, right?
It's probably everything that I just said, where it's like, people are like, okay, he's 36 years old. The plate discipline keeps getting worse and worse. The quality of contact's amazing, but at some point it just becomes musical chairs. And I'm sure also more so it's the fact that I bet he's just out here looking for a 2-year deal. He's like, I had a 900 OPS last year. Why wouldn't I get a 2-year deal? But it's just like, I'm sure no one in the league is willing to do that. The same reason that Jordan Montgomery's out there. He apparently still wants a 6 or 7 year deal. Everyone's probably like, we'll give you 3 or 4. And he's like, no. Blake Snell, the qualifying offer. No one wants to give him a long-term deal because he's not been reliable over the course of his career. So it's like, these three guys are all out there for very specific specific reasons. I also think that's why Solari and Matt Chapman did get their contracts. Like Matt Chapman, you can say what you want about him, how weird he's been the last few years, but he's a solid baseball player. You put him out there, you don't feel that bad about it. Jorge Soler, like, I don't know how much he's going to play, but if he's hitting in your lineup, like, he's going to put a lot of balls over the fence.
Correct.
These three guys, it's a little bit weirder, especially with the qualifying offer for Snell. So I think that's a weird thing. And just, I don't know, like, stuck playing musical chairs. Got a 30% strikeout rate last year. He was in the best offense in baseball, one of the best offense in baseball in recent memory. It's just, it's weird. Like, why is this the moment where this happens? And also just the fact that it was John Heyman saying the Mets are involved. It's like, that's so obviously just a ploy to try and get the Angels to give him a 2-year contract. Yeah. So obviously it's just, it's always the Angels. Always come back to the Angels show. I don't think it's going to happen. I also think it's just like, it's kind of endemic to all a bunch of other stuff going on at the Mets, like what this whole offseason has been about, just trying to build it back up from the ground, like not get ahead of ourselves or try and go crazy on the free agent market. Tim Britton had a great article on The Athletic for anyone that subscribed about the Mets payroll situation. And it's just the key issues and how this payroll got so, for lack of a better term, fucked up over the last few years and how it feels kind of unfixable now that we just kind of have to sit in the second, third tax tier for the next couple of seasons. And the key issue, and it always comes back to this, the Mets basically have no pre-arbitration players on this roster. We're going on years now. Like right now, like Alvarez is the crown jewel. We have him. Bailey and Vientos are going to get time. But it's just that you really lack this like underbelly, this foundation of what modern baseball teams want. And that's like cheap production from young athletic players. And last year, the Mets were in danger of being the only team in baseball to have zero pre-arbitration players in their entire opening day roster. Zero. They wound up having two. Can you name who those two guys were last year, pre-arbitration players, the Mets opening day roster?
On opening day? Mm-hmm. All right, I'm just going to go like position by position here. I don't think it's anybody in the infield because we spoke earlier and you said it's not Alvarez or Beatty because they didn't start the year up.
They did not
so
last year.
So it's got to be the Tim LeCastro?
No, he was not pre-arb. He's been in the league for like 7 years.
I know, but I just figured like he's played like what, like 60 games total in those 7 years? Like maybe that's the weird one. Okay, so on the pitching side,
Tim LeCastro also had the phantom injury right before opening day, remember?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that was the fake injury.
Yeah,
that
to keep him around. Was the injury. Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah, that's the one that got him and Daniel Vogelback. Wow, who would it be?
One,
I don't know.
One I think makes a lot of sense. One, it's like you're never going to get it.
Okay. Tyler McGill?
No, I think there was an injury last year and he didn't make the roster. He wasn't ready opening day or something.
David Peterson?
It was David Peterson. He's the obvious one. The other one's bizarre. You'll never get it. It was Steven Nogosek.
Oh, yeah, I don't like that guy's pitching, so that's why I'm trying to blank him out of my head.
Yeah, so in terms of even the guys you had in your roster pre-arb opening day last year, one of them got shelled, and the other one got shelled and got cut. So it's like you weren't getting any production out of players that you weren't really paying any money, which is like a shitty way to talk about this, but it's kind of just the way modern baseball works now. If you look at the good teams, even right now the Dodgers are the only team who are going to have less pre-arbitration players. They're opening their roster in the Mets, but they just spent $1 billion and they just do not care. And they have pre-arb guys that have graduated who still don't make tons of money on that roster who are going to contribute. A guy like Gavin Lux, who most fans would laugh at, but he's probably going to be like 15, 260 and play defense in multiple places on a team that was going to go to the World Series. Max Muncy like still makes money, but it's not crazy. Will Smith is an arb guy, but he's like one of the best catchers in the league. He makes not much money relatively. Like they still have that. But you look at teams like the Astros, the Yankees, the motherfucking Braves, even the Phillies now with what they're doing around that infield and that bullpen, like the amount of production that you get from guys who really don't make any money that you brought up through your system, that gives you so much more flexibility to do other stuff. And that's just haven't been able to do that. So the only way to have a sustainably good team without spending tons of money is to get a pipeline and start doing that. It's what you have to start doing. You have to.
Sustainability. And I mean, the farm system is looking good. Like we're super excited with what we've seen down there. And eventually those guys will come up and start making some, you know, production at this major league roster. But yeah, I mean, you think about the core of this team, this core was around in 2018, 2019, and it's now 2024. So like nobody's cheap anymore. Literally every single person gets paid on this roster.
No, Jeff McNeil's big money. Pete Alonso has a big money 1-year deal. He's going to need big money next year. Brandon was a big money player. And like, if you do sign a JD Martinez or a JD Davis, that does flex both Brett Beatty, or at least Mark Vientos and possibly Brett Beatty out of a role where I think most Mets fans have probably soured on both of them by this point, but you at least, even if you get one of those guys to become a 2 or 3 win player, like that gives you one of these guys to put in the roster for the next couple of years and be able to bank on that. And now you have more money to spend elsewhere. It's just, there's just too much money given out to players who run spectacular in this roster to really be able to do this year over year consistently. Even next year, all the money coming off the books, it's going to be like 9 players on the roster. One of them still going to be Starling Marte. Like if you want to compete again, if you want to sign Pete Alonso, Corbin Burns, and Juan Soto, you have to go back into the third tax threshold all of a sudden again. And that's without getting more Starling starting pitchers or more outfielders, because you're not going to have that many. It's just you need to build this thing from the bottom. And I think this JD Martinez, JD Davis thing would be like, we got so close to getting to the season with really focusing on building it from the bottom, and you lose it the last second. I don't really think David Stearns will. This is not his vibe. I could see something like this happening in like June if the Mets were 25-20. They're like, okay, let's start playing ball. Like we have our playoff projections now got over 50%. Like, let's try and lock this in. But right now in March, when we don't know what's going to happen, we don't even know about Kodai Senga. Like, let's just chill on these guys.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think JD Davis would be a good guy to bring in, but also at the same time, again, how much of a difference does it really make for this team? And you make a good point. We got to find out what Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos have at some point. Like, just this is the year, throw them into the fire. And if they don't perform, that's when you move on. You find somebody else who can. So, sucks because we like Brett Beatty over here and we like Vientos as well. But at some point, these guys got to wake up a little bit. Like, it's just lack of a better term. Got to wake up and play better baseball.
Yeah, that's it. And then good time now to take this conversation, move it for the guys we are talking about on the team into batting order stuff. We said we wanted to talk about it on Sunday, but we kind of had a lot to talk about, so we didn't want that to be like an hour, 20-minute episode. Yeah. Maybe we should have because it was hotter, but I think like cooler heads have prevailed, and the two games the Mets have played now, because we're recording this Wednesday afternoon, guys, so we're going to miss the Wednesday night game, but it's like half and half starters, relievers, but we're starters bench guys. We're going to miss Fuji. We're going to miss Severino stuff, but we'll talk about that next week or maybe the stream on Friday, but the two games have been played because lineups are the out. Marte hit fifth both times, and Nimmo, Lindor, Alonso, Alvarez in some way were the top four in the order. So I think that is what we wanted. That's what we hoped for. This lineup did happen the other day, though. The Edwin Diaz debut, it scored zero runs, which is kind of hilarious. But I still think, and I always will think, like, this is the best way to set the Mets lineup at the top.
Yeah, totally. Question, do you care if the team's not scoring runs in spring training? Does that worry you at all? That was a conversation I had at the stadium with some people, and they were like, well, this team's not scoring. What's going on? I'm like, it's spring training. Like, who fucking cares?
Definitely not at all. I mean, because if you're scared that a team's not scoring, then you shouldn't be scared about the Mets starting pitchers, right? Because they have the best pitching ERA in the league. Like, you can't have it both ways. You can't ignore. You honestly, here's the thing: spring training is funny. I was listening. The power went out, so SNY was missing the first couple things of the broadcast on Monday night, Tuesday night, whenever that was. So I was listening to Keith Rapp, Pat McCarthy on the radio, and they were kind of saying like, with spring training, you can't have it both ways negative, but you can have it both ways positive, which is something that we like to stroke on this podcast. We're like, good things, like, nice, you're doing good. Bad thing is spring training, you're working on stuff. But you can't say the good doesn't count and the bad does count. You cannot say that. That's just you being a pessimist, and you gotta shake the cobwebs loose a little bit. But
yeah,
I won't say it's like not super worrisome, because like, I'm not worried about Francisco Lindor. I'm not worried about Brandon Nimmo. Not worried about Pete Alonso. Not worried about Francisco Alvarez. But like, Starling Marte being 2-for-18 with one of those two being a drag bunt, that is kind of a little worrisome given what he's been doing the last few years. Beatty can't lift the ball, but he's hit a bunch of balls over 105 miles an hour exit velocity. Same with Viento. So like, that's not really a worry. It's like, oh, these are the guys I thought they were. And like, Jeff Neal isn't playing. So in terms of the starters, I'm like, I don't know. It's hard to get tremendously worried about being like, we have the best pitching in the league.
Yeah, and I mean, it coming back to the lineup now, like, you talked about Marte being 2-for-18. It's funny how, like, a week, or I guess when this first conversation happened, people were like, Marte's got a leadoff. This guy steals bases. He does this. He does that. It's like, the way that we need to build a lineup, especially for this Mets roster that, like, offensively, it's top-heavy. I think that's safe to say. You have to put your first three guys to get the most at-bats. And I know you've got some stats on where guys are hitting, and I know people are like, oh, Lindor in the two-hole, he has a lower batting average. It's like, scratch. I don't fucking care. Like, it's nonsense. And if you look at his career numbers, a lot of his at-bats in the two-hole came earlier in his career when he was a worse player. So, like, there's an entire season where he just wasn't the greatest as, like, a 20-year-old playing for the Guardians hitting two. Where, like, I can't get worried about the batting average stuff when we know that these guys are just good hitters.
What you just said about Lindor specifically, I don't think is true, because I think the thing that's killing Lindor's two-hole batting average is the first year with the Mets, where he hit two for the entire year.
That one, too.
And hit 220. When he came up from the Guardians, from the get-go, he was a baller. Like, that 60 games were good.
No, he had one. Then it was the next year after that, maybe then. The next year after that, when they hit him in the two-hole, he was really bad. I looked at it because I wanted to yell at people on Twitter.
Because look at it again, because I don't really remember that. I can't vouch for that. Maybe it was like a bad 2 months at the beginning of the second year, because I think he still was just like hit the ground running overall for the full season. He was like my first like dynasty baseball darling. Him and Ozzie Albies like a year apart, where I was like, I'm figuring it out. I think that the big thing I want to talk about right now, I did a lot of research, got some data. I want to expand on something we talked about the other night, where it was, it's significantly more important in the batting order who's hitting ahead of you and who hits behind you. And like, I know that a lot of people are going to ignore this. A lot of people are going to roll their eyes like, oh, this fucking nerd on the Messed Up podcast is going to try and tell me these things. But it's just, there's so much around like this idea of protection in the batting order that's been like debunked by stats over the last like decade or so, where it's just, it's an old baseball thing. It makes a lot of sense in your brain who's sitting behind you, but it just, it doesn't really make sense on the field and the numbers anymore. And if for all like real crazy nerd dork baseball people out there, look up Tom Tango pitching around batters. It was a Fangraphs and Community Post or Hardball Times from like 2005 or 2006, where it just took this idea of like guys hitting behind you and guys hitting ahead of you, like who you're going to see the best pitches. And I want to go back to the Mike Petriello article I talked about also on Monday, where I misspoke a little bit. The article was actually specifically about Otani. I misspoke a lot of things on Sunday. I was like kind of sick recording. It was just like, it was Warrior podcasting, the hardest job in the world. But last year, across all of Major League Baseball, when the bases were empty, hitters had 720 OPS. With men on, it was 753 OPS. That's not like a stark difference, but it's the whole league. That's a pretty big difference, 30 points of OPS, 720 versus 753. It's basically like a tear under league average to like a little bit above league average. So that's something right there. And in this article that was specifically about Otani, he was talking about the fact that he's going to be better because he has like protection, but the protection is going to be Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman rather than like Will Smith and Teoscar Hernandez. Last year, Otani had a better wOBA with Taylor Ward hitting behind him than Mike Trout. And he saw more strikes with Taylor Ward hitting behind him compared to Mike Trout, which is probably a thing of pitchers where like, I want to go after this guy. I don't want to walk someone before Mike Trout comes up. Or it's just like, he's active a hitter. It doesn't really matter. So, but in terms of the numbers last year in 2023, pitchers were less likely to challenge Otani with Mike Trout behind him. So that idea of protection kind of goes away. The biggest difference for Otani specifically last year was with guys on base versus the bases empty. The bases empty, he had an 888 OPS with a 146 OPS plus. With men on base, it was a 1067 OPS and a 179 OPS plus.
Not bad.
It's a lot different. And it's just because, and I think a lot of factors kind of like bleed into this. One is like, if you're a pitcher and you're allowing guys to get on base, theoretically, you're probably worse than someone who's just mowing everybody down in order. So facing worse pitchers, you're going to have higher OPS plus. And also last year specifically, just about all the new rules, holding runners on, letting guys stealing. It was like, it's just so much more chaos in your mind with a guy on base. I think that was a real fear. And then I want to bring it back to the Mets now, because this article, Mike Petriello actually did talk about Pete Alonso a little bit in it, because I know Mets fans, Mike's a New York guy, clamor for this protection for Pete. Pete Alonso last year had a better wOBA with Daniel Vogelback hitting behind him than Jeff McNeil.
Oh, don't tell people that.
But he also got more strikes with Jeff McNeil behind him, which is weird. He had a better wOBA with the guy who was getting, when he was being pitched around more often, which also says a little thing about whoever hitting behind Pete, kind of what makes him a little more comfortable. Also, it's hard to take everything with Pete last year because of the injury, but there's a lot more stats about Pete from last year, from his whole career, about him with runners on base and him with the bases empty that just should hammer home the fact that we need to put as much talent in front of Pete as possible, but we can't move him down the order to do it. Last year, Pete Alonso had a 730 OPS with the bases empty and a 100 WRC plus. He was a league average player, average player with nobody on base, which is terrifying. With men on base, that was 910 and 142 with runners on. So he basically goes from Alec Boehm to Bryce Harper, whether there's men on base or nobody on base, to give an analogy Mets fans could understand there.
Yeah.
Just take a shot at the Phillies, because Alec Boehm is always criminally overrated. Maybe he breaks out this year. Who the hell knows? But the worst part by far about all this Pete Alonso stuff, I just told you guys how he's significantly better men on base and with the bases empty. But last year he hit fourth for most of the year, which I've said in this podcast before kind of jokingly.
That's
the second leadoff spot in the order. Last year, Pete Alonso had 329 plate appearances with men on base and 329 plate appearances with the bases empty, which is not okay. And maybe, okay, the Mets lineup wasn't that good last year. We had some offensive struggles, this and that. But you know what? Pete Alonso last season led off innings 156 times. That was the second most inning at-bats to lead off an inning on the entire team, only behind the actual leadoff hitter, Brandon Nimmo. And there were four guys in the Mets last year that had at least 630 plate appearances: Alonso, Nimmo, Lindor, and McNeil. And Alonso had the second most plate appearances leading off innings. That's not okay. You might think, okay, maybe it's just because the Mets, the guys had injuries, guys moved around the order, this and that. Pete Alonso had the 47th most at-bats leadoff inning in the whole league last year. There's 30 leadoff hitters in baseball, and he was 47. He was in the second tier of guys leading off innings. You know why? That's because he hit fourth. When you hit third, you're not leading off innings. It's not going to happen. I think that's the biggest thing for this Mets lineup. He cannot hit fourth anymore. We don't have enough good hitters ahead of him, and you have to do everything you can for him to have as many at-bats as possible with guys on base.
Yeah, I mean, we were always about that the 1-2-3 should include Pete Alonso, Lindor, and Nimmo to begin with. But now hearing that leading off stat, you're swaying me a little bit more on that. That fourth spot is the second leadoff. You're swaying me a little bit more there, stat nerd.
let that be McNeil. Let McNeil hit behind Pete. Let Marte hit. Let McNeil go back there, and then Alvarez. Because then the conversation is like Alvarez hit fourth. He's Pete's protection. But I think there's a fear that the same thing could happen to Francisco Alvarez. I don't want Francisco Alvarez having any at bats with men on base. And also, if there's one hole still in Francisco Alvarez's game, it's probably going to be his on base percentage. You guys just heard how often Pete Alonso led off innings last year because he was in the four hole. I don't want Francisco Alvarez leading off innings either. Like, there's a good chance it doesn't happen that often. You made that great point on Monday about most pitchers' whips are not going to be below one, so you're always probably like you're about going to get one guy on per inning. But still, the point still holds. Like, don't ever put yourself in a possibility where this could happen. Let Alvarez hit fifth. Let him get more accustomed to this. Put McNeil at four. It's going to be hilarious that Jeff McNeil at four. He's going to have crazy funny comments about it in press conferences. Like, I'm the cleanup hitter now, but you have to sit him down and be like, doesn't make you a cleanup hitter. Get the cleanup hitter thing out of your head. You're still leadoff. Get on base. Just get on base. Play your game. But it's just don't let these guys get on base. Get up and no one on base.
And I will say this, and maybe this will make Mets fans feel a little bit better too. Like, in a world where Jeff McNeil gets up in the first inning, right? And he's no longer the second leadoff. Let's just pretend now he's actually hitting fourth. With runners in scoring position, McNeil puts the ball in play. That's kind of something you want when you have guys on base. You want that ball in play. So I don't even hate the idea that McNeil hitting fourth, again, not the Buck Showalter cleanup hitter, not our big bruiser first baseman, even though we know that's a stupid idea. But I don't hate the idea of like having a high contact guy hit fourth behind Pete for the reasons you just said. And if you're not the worst case scenario is the guy who gets 200 hits a year has a chance to get a hit with a guy on base now rather than hitting in the two hole or whatever it's going to be. And I think this is like a bigger conversation that just baseball, I think, probably needs to have in general that doesn't get talked about enough, because you like the Dodgers, obviously, that lineup is obvious. A lot of teams' lineups are very, very obvious as to who's going to hit where. But it's interesting to see, like, that's very much a Rays approach that you would take, hitting a McNeil fourth. You wouldn't see that from a lot of the other teams in baseball. And, I mean, like, even looking at, like, a guy like Matt Olson, who I just wanted to pull up his numbers even, with no men on base last year, 896 OPS, great. With men on base, he had an 1105 OPS. He hit 331 with men on base last year, 242 without men on base. It's the classic, like, I can kind of pitch around him. Like, if this is the guy who gets on base, slow on the base pass, pitch around him, that's not the worst thing ever.
It's a similar thing last year also what the Astros were doing when they were at their best towards the end of the year. Once Altuve came back and Jose Abreu was like back towards like the bottom, you know, they're like 5-6 after they tried him at the top. But they went Altuve, who a lot of people talk about Nimmo, where it's like he's too good of a power hitter now to hit at the leadoff. But it's like, how many years Altuve going to hit 25, 30 home runs leadoff?
How about their other leadoff hitter? Yeah, George Springer. Yeah. How about Mookie Betts hitting leadoff? How about like all these guys that hit leadoff? Who gives a fuck if they hit too many home runs? I don't get that argument. It feels like the least amount of thinking, because you're like, home run, if he hits fourth, they're surely going to be men on base. It's like, not necessarily.
Totally. But then after that, when you had their batting order again, when they're playing at their best, it went Bregman, who I think is probably their best all-around player, kind of compares similarly to Lindor for their lineup, where it's like high on base, the OPS never going to get crazy, but it's like high on base, hits the home runs when they come. What?
Kyle Tucker, too. Don't forget Kyle Tucker.
But this is where I'm going with this. And Alvarez, three, because he is the best hitter in the lineup. He's the biggest run producer. He's the most powerful. But then Tucker was the four, where I think if most baseball fans look at Kyle Tucker, he's not your prototypical four hitter at all, like by no stretch of the imagination. Like, he's a good all-around player. He's kind of compares actually more favorably to Nimmo. He's like if Brandon Nimmo was like supercharged.
And from like Texas or Florida, not Wyoming.
He's like if Brandon was playing competitive baseball when he was 7 years old instead of 17 years old. But that's like that. People would be like, that's an unconventional leadoff hitter because he's more of like a 370 on base percentage guy with like 25, 30 homer power, steals bags, high batting average, bat to ball guy. But that I think is because I don't know. The Astros kind of moving further away from analytics. I just use them anecdotally because I want to just like keep changing the image of leadoff four hitters, cleanup hitters in baseball fans' minds. But it's just that we have to think about it differently. And everything it just said, like you, especially in context of where this lineup is and how few guys in this team really have elite power, the two of them being truthfully Pete Alonso, Francisco Alvarez, we should be doing everything in our power as an organization to not allow them to ever get up with no men on base. Ever.
If you hit Pete third, it's probably going to never happen. He's probably never going to lead off an inning. Like, man, who's like a guy who hits third for the entire year? I'd love to see how many times they led off an inning.
Do some lookups right now. I mean, do Alvarez or... I mean, Alvarez hit fourth for a part of the year. Actually, no, Alvarez never... Jordan Alvarez hit fourth 0 games last year for the...
Okay, so look up how many times he led off
one game. One game. Three games. I'm at 3 games for Alvarez leading off.
Let's see how many times he led off an inning. Because if it's that low, like, You're on something here, James Schiano.
The fact that Pete Alonso led off an inning the 47th most times in baseball last year is a huge issue. And the fact that he had as many at-bats with men on base compared to no men on base, that's inexcusable. It can't happen. It shouldn't happen. That we should do everything we can to not let that ever happen again. Just because the bottom of the order isn't going to be that great this year. We're going to have to talk about the bottom of the order now to close this out. It's just, it probably isn't. Like, there's, if McNeil, Alvarez, and Marte, if all of them start hitting, and then you get something from either Bailey or Vientos, and then Harrison Bader is not the worst hitter in baseball, it's passable. Like, you can make things happen down there, and you can have some fun. You can have the run and gun bomb of the order. Jeff McNeil could steal 10 bases. Starling Marte could steal 40 bases. Alvarez could hit 30 home runs. Like, these are, we're saying the bottom of the order. This is like the guys 4 through 9. Like, Bailey and Vientos, if they combine for 36 home runs, I'll be happy as hell. Happy as a clam. But it's just, it's probably not going to be that good. So we have to do everything we can for the top of this order to create as many runs as possible. And that starts with Nimmo, Lindor, Alonso.
Yeah, totally. And you're hard to find a better 1-2-3 in the league. Like, there are better. I'm not saying they're the best. But, like, that puts you in the upper third of the top of the order. And you put pressure on these pitchers to start the game. Like, you can't come into this game and be like, there's an easy out in this top three of this lineup. There's not. Nimmo makes you work at bats. Lindor is obviously a beast. Pete Alonso is the best power hitter in baseball. It's just, I think sometimes we get obsessed with trying to make players like fit an idea. Like you said with Brandon Nimmo, like, he's developing power now. The on-base percentage dropped. Yeah, his on-base percentage is still 360, which I think, if I looked the other day on Fangraphs, is like the third or fourth highest among leadoff hitters in baseball last year. So, like, yeah, it's not 400, but it's still elite. Like, I don't know if people really understand what they're saying sometimes.
It's also, we talked about the other day, if there was another very obvious leadoff option in this team, like, I would be all for Brandon moving down the order. I would, again, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I love Brandon on the four hole. Like, if Drew Gilbert right now was ready to be like a 350 on base guy at the major league level, or Jett Williams, I'd be like, yeah, make him leadoff. We'll put Brandon Nimmo at four. Brandon Nimmo at four could have like a 270, 380, like 530 season with like 30 homers and 90 RBIs. Like, that is possible, but he's too valuable right now in leadoff. Like, I don't want to have a bad leadoff hitter so I can have a good four hitter. Like, I don't want to, you can't steal from Peter to pay Paul. Like, you can't do that. You just can't do it. You have, by the way, if your nose to spite your face, how many little sayings are we going to do here? This is pretty good. Kind of stuff that Buck Showalter would have actually been able to understand, but I digress.
Yeah, digress. I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, top of the order is good. We need the bottom of the order to step up, and at some point, those guys are going to have to do it. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to take, but throw them into the fire. Figure it out. Like, the bottom of the order, I'll tell you this, and this might sound crazy, but, like, I couldn't care less, like, how they order 7, 8, 9. Like, who gives a shit? I don't care at all. Do you feel that same way?
No, I mean, just put Bader 9. He smells like a 9 hitter to me.
Yeah.
But Alvarez last year, Jordan Alvarez, a callback from before, he led off innings 95 times last year. And that was, let me get this number here. Savant does not order these, so I'm going to have to do quick shitty math. There are how many guys in this list? He's like right in the middle. That was about the 215th most often in the whole league leading off. He played, I think, like 150 something games. So that's the kind of thing where it's just like, if you're hitting third, you're not ever going to lead off innings. But if you're hitting fourth, you're going to lead off plenty of innings.
Yeah. And I think that's a good way to think about it. That's the Mets lineup talk there for you guys. Last thing we're going to mention is going to be the spring breakout. I think I'm like 80% sure we're going to be streaming, watching this game live. 80% sure. I'm watching a dog for a couple weeks of a friend. Shout out Sammy. And it's getting dropped off on Friday. So, like, it could be chaos having a stream go on with a dog that's in a new apartment that it's never been in before. But also, maybe that's good content. Maybe that's what you guys want to see, is me running around trying to figure out how to take care of a dog. But, the spring breakout, I mean, the Mets roster looks pretty interesting. There's some good players on there. We talked about it briefly that none of the big name pitchers are going to be there. But as we know, that's probably because they just want them to be a little bit more focused on getting ready for the season rather than pitching in this game. But we still get to see Blade Tidwell. Still get to see those guys around the league. Someone I'm particularly interested in, I'm really interested in Marco Vargas and Jeremy Rodriguez. I got to see Vargas taking a bat in the 8th inning in Port St. Lucie during the Edwin Diaz game. And I got to say, a little bit bigger than I thought in terms of like size and muscle, like a little bit stronger than I thought he was going to look. And his swing looks really nice. It's really compact. He hit a line drive up the middle. They were just playing him perfectly, so it went right to a guy. But someone I'm interested to see get more at-bats, and there's just not a lot of tape on Jeremy Rodriguez. So those are two guys specifically for me that I'm trying to watch.
No, Rodriguez is amazing. There was a great blurb about Jeremy Rodriguez and the Fangraphs top 100 prospects, because he has snuck into the back end of some top 100 lists, including, I believe, Fangraphs and Baseball Perspectives, who are usually kind of the sharpest of these lists, but they have a kind of a different grading system than Baseball America. Like we've talked about in this show, it's Eric Logan-Hangen, who's amazing, one of the best in the business, he compared Jeremy Rodriguez in terms of, because he's turning 18 soon, so he'd be technically like a high school draft eligible player this year. He compared his stock coming into the summer as someone like Jett Williams or Colt Emerson.
Whoa.
Someone who could be like a mid to back end first round pick with upside and hitting upside the plate and ability to probably stick a short, but possibly also move off depending on how the body developed. And also share the fact that he had a 19% chase rate last year in the DSL. 19% Whoa. Chase rate is lunacy. Also a 93% zone contact rate. The 19% chase rate would be in the 95th percentile in Major League Baseball if it was a chase rate. Same as Alex Bregman last year, second Bregman mentioned on this episode of the Messed Up Podcast. So I think he's someone who's interesting. It's also just so fun because now we have this guy to root for. Be like, we got this guy for 2 months of Tommy Pham.
Yeah.
Like, Mets fans, whatever happens to Jeremy Rodriguez, we could say this for the next 3 years.
Yes.
Like, we got a top 100 prospect for 2 months of Tommy Pham. Like, what's your organization doing? Like, this is the kind of things you could hold on when your major league team isn't playing super well. And you could be like, this is what we're doing. We're better than you.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. The spring breakout games, like just in general, I think you guys should watch them. Cool thing, I think they're going to be all available on MLB TV, no blackouts for these games. So you'll be able to watch all the teams, and they start on the 14th, run to the 17th, and the Mets play on the 15th?
15th, Friday after Friday, 3 o'clock.
Friday, 3 o'clock. So keep posted on the Mets Up Twitter and Instagram and all that kind of stuff as for the live stream details. Again, I think it's going to happen, but crazier things have happened in this world, so maybe I'm not going to say 100% because I'm really bad at living up to my promise sometimes. But that being said, lots of good stuff going on in the Mets baseball world. We'll obviously keep talking with you guys about it. Anything else here to talk about, James, before we wrap it up?
I just wanted to let go, like, rapid fire a couple more of these spring breakout guys because just some fun guys. I think a lot of, like, prospects that Mets fans might not know. Like, Brandon Sproat, he went right to the complex last year, didn't pitch professionally. He got, like, the full Christian Scott floor of the overhaul. Ditched the sinkers, throwing a fastball now with, like, great horizontal movement on it. 18 to 19 inches of IVB for the pitching people out there. It's just, like, that means coming up, you know, like that. And apparently 100 miles an hour. Nolan McLean's also throwing 100 miles an hour, another draftee last year. Nothing I was wrong on Monday, Jesus Baez. I thought he was a big guy. He's just a strong guy, but he's a small guy. He's like a 5'9", like 190 kind, but he's apparently already, rumors are of 108-109 mile per hour max exit velocity.
Whoa.
And I think it was the DSL or in the complex, but as an 18-year-old kid, that's pretty insane. And then Tyler Stewart, he's kind of a step behind the Hamill, the Vassell, the Christian Scott tier of pitchers, but last year between Brooklyn and Binghamton, 2.2 ERA, 25% strikeout rate, 7% walk rate. Like, he's someone who could be impressive and could be like, he could be a good barometer where it's like, if he makes it to the major leagues and is effective, now the Mets have pure pitching development magic where it's like, we just got a major league pitcher come out of nowhere.
Yeah, he's also a mountain of a human. He's 6'9", 250, and he comes from University of Southern Mississippi from the 2022 MLB draft. Southern Miss, low-key a bit of a pitching factory. That's actually where Hurston Waldrop started off before he transferred to Florida. So they've got a little bit of a track record of having some pitching over the last couple seasons and guys that are flying through systems. I truthfully have not watched, I feel like, any actual Tyler Stewart clips, but I know numbers are good, so I'm excited to see what he can do in this game as well.
Yeah, a lot of fun guys. Again, Mets have a fun roster. It's going to be cool to play against Nationals. I think James Wood and Dylan Cruz are both playing in this game, too, which would be really fun to watch. Brady House, I think, as well. Some exciting high draft picks from that Nationals team. But it's a fun event. This is the best thing that Major League Baseball has done for marketing since steroids. I'm really excited for it.
I think I like that you keep dropping that in there, the steroids line. Why not? Fuck it. They knew it was happening. They were aware. They were complicit. Bud Selig saved baseball. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, all right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. Remember to follow us on all our social media at MetsUp on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Subscribe to the MetsUp YouTube channel to see the video version of this. And if you're listening to us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, drop us a rating, drop us a review, download and subscribe. Follow James on Twitter at
James_Shiano.
And me at GiraffeNeckMark with a C. We'll catch you guys on the next episode. Peace out.
Peace out. See you guys next time.